appreciate that. Were you trying to say that I'm going to put them to sleep and they need to wake up before this goes on? I want to say thank you to Kevin for a couple of things. One, I'm going to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. And I'm going to say thank you for not using a PowerPoint last week, because that didn't make me feel like a sore thumb. And I'm going to tell him thank you for speaking a little bit longer for the last couple of weeks, because that way if I talk for 30, 35 minutes, y'all won't think bad of me. Don't tell him I said that either. I wanted to take just a minute of your time and tell you thank you for the welcome that you've given to my family and I as we've begun to worship here with you. I'm a big believer in why. Anytime my children do something and they need correcting, I have a habit of, before I punish them, I always try to get to the bottom of it, figure out why they did it, why they acted the way that they did. And they sometimes look at me rather funny as I'm sitting there trying to ask them, why did you do this? Why was it? What was behind it? And that's where I want to go this morning, is why. If I were to ask you for a show of hands this morning and said, how many of us know of someone? That is, that we have knowledge of someone. Maybe you've heard of somebody in another city, maybe in another congregation in this town or in the state, who was once a faithful, active member of the church, and yet it's turned back. You ever thought about how many of us would raise our hands? What if we brought it a little bit closer home and said, all right, how many of us know someone personally? That is, we have a friend that we would feel comfortable confiding in or going to if we had a problem. A close personal acquaintance who was once a Christian and faithful and active and yet has turned back. Now let's bring it just a little bit closer home. What if we said, how many of us have someone who by blood or marriage is kin to us, who was once faithful, active, and yet now has turned back? What's really sad is the fact is that almost every person over the age of 10 in this audience would have raised your hands all three times. Because we all know people, we all have friends, and most all of us have relatives who have turned back. So why is that? I think that in the book of Galatians, Paul really gives us a good idea as to why it is that people turn back. And I think that if we want to guard against turning back, that the fact is we need to understand why it is that people turn back. If you remember in John chapter 6, if you want to turn over there, I want to look just for a minute before we really get into the lesson at something that happened in the life of Jesus. In John chapter 6, toward the end of the chapter, in verses 53 and following, Jesus said, most assuredly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will not have eternal life. He goes on to kind of expound on this in the people. It says in verse 59, and these things he said in the synagogues as he taught in Capernaum. Many of the disciples, when they heard this, they said, this is a hard saying. Who can understand it? Jesus expounded on it. And then in verse 66, it says, from that time on, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. Verse 47, Jesus looked at the 12 apostles. He said, do you also want to go away? Peter answered him and said, Lord, to whom shall we go? Put your marker there. We're going to come back to that verse at the end of the lesson. Peter looks and says, where are we going to go? What are we going to turn back to? Who are we going to go to? And I'm afraid that far too often we have that attitude toward people who turn back. We kind of look at them and kind of smirk. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Where are you going? Well, while that is true, where are we going to go? When we don't understand why it is that people turn back, how is it we're going to fix that? How is it that we're going to guard against it in our own lives? Because I really hope and pray that the goal of every person in here is to get to heaven. I know it is mine. I hope you want to go to heaven more than you want to take another breath. I hope that you would have the same attitude that Paul did when he said, you know, for me to live is Christ, but to die is gain. And if it was really his choice, he would have just gone ahead and died. And I hope that we all have that same attitude that what I really want in this life is to get to the end of this life so I can get to something much better. Look in Galatians chapter 1. The whole book of Galatians was not written to a church. It was written to many churches. And they all had the same problem. They all had the same issue going on. And that was that they were all turning back. Paul, if you notice in the first five verses here, he kind of gets them sucked in, so to speak, and draws them a little closer with, you know, just kind of a friendly greeting. And then he doesn't waste any time in verse 6 when he says, I marvel that you're turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. He says, how in the world is it that you're turning away so quickly? You hadn't been Christians that long. You hadn't been it hadn't been that long since you were immersed. It hadn't been long since it was established there in those places. And he says, how is it you're turning away so soon? So why is it that people turn away so quickly? I think that Paul tells us the answer three things in the book of Galatians. Chapters 4, 5, and 6. There are three verses that I believe give us the answer. Why is it that people turn back? Let's look in chapter 4 first. How is it that people turn back so soon? Well, first reason is this. It says in verse 17 of chapter 4, they zealously court you. Now, before he says that, before he jumps into that, Paul kind of, he tells them thank you, basically. He tells them because he said, you know, he talks about his physical infirmities in verses 13 and 14. And then in verse 15, he even says, if it was possible, you would have even plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. And then he says in verse 16, have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Now, that's something we all need to remember. Just because somebody tells us the truth, just because somebody tells us what we need to hear, that does not make them our enemy. That makes them our friend in reality. And Paul says, they zealously court you. I want to read that to you from a different version. Some of the New Century Version, it was actually derived quite a few years ago, and it was designed for people who were deaf. It was designed for people who read Braille. And they could understand this much better. It says in verse 17, those people are working hard to persuade you. But it's not good for you. They want to persuade you to turn against us and follow only them. I'll read it again out of the New King James. They zealously court you, but for no good. Yes, they want to exclude you that you may be zealous for them. They zealously court you. These people are after you, so to speak. We don't. I'm always amazed when my kids start talking to me about romance and the way that it works in this day and age. And it's almost as though it's like a negotiating process. When you hear them talking about somebody that what we would say was they were dating, and yet they say, well, they're talking. Well, what are they talking about? I don't know. Then they start to say, well, are they dating? Yeah, okay, now they're dating, but they were talking, and I don't understand all of it. When I was little, I grew up basically with my grandparents. So a lot of the terminology that I use in life, it really came from a different generation. And we used to talk about people courting. And you know, when I say that to Hannah, Ruth, and Red, I said, somebody's courting, they look at me, what? Well, that means they're talking to you. I told Hannah the other night, I was telling her about when April and I had begun courting. And we only dated for a few months before I went off to Florida College. And I was telling Hannah Ruth, I said, I know y'all think that I'm crazy and just kind of fly by the seat of my pants and not very calculating. But I said, you know, when I left to go to college, the one thing that I wanted more than anything else was April. I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. So I was telling Hannah, I said, you know, so everything that I did while I was away, I tried to be very calculating and very deliberate in what I said, how I acted, the things that I gave her, the way that I communicated, because I said, I knew that that was the only chance that I had, really. We've lost that somewhere in our society. The idea of courting and the idea of trying to it's, let's just face it, it's trying to convince somebody else to spend the rest of their life with us. And I think that's the idea that Paul is trying to get across to us, is that these people in the world out there are trying to court us. They're trying to convince us to basically spend our life for them. Turn over to the book of Luke, chapter 22. This is probably the most famous instance we can find of someone being courted, so to speak, to do something very bad. In Luke 22, it says in verse 1, Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover, and the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way, and he conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray them. Did you notice that word conferred? What does that mean? Let's put it in 20th century terms. If you're trying to sell something to someone else, if you have a job that involves sales and you're trying to get somebody to buy something in large quantities from you, what do? Well, you don't call them on the phone and say, hey, would you like to buy this? And they say no, and say, okay, thank you, bye. You call them and you start talking to them about who they are, where they're from, what they do, where they've been. You try to get close to them. You try to develop a relationship with them. Then you say, hey, why don't I take you out to lunch? Maybe we'll go out to dinner. Hey, why don't we go play some golf together? And we'll have a good time and we'll get to know each other. And then you develop a relationship and then you say, hey, you know, I sell this and I know that you need something, so why don't we? That's the way you sell something. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that's the way the world sells sin to us. It's the way that the world, the people outside those doors, sell us on sin, on turning back, on going back and leaving the church, going into the world. It's the same way it works. I rather doubt that Judas and his whole discussion here with these chief priests and captains, I doubt it lasted just a couple of seconds. It only took us probably 20 seconds to read those few verses. I rather think it lasted a little bit longer. I think he probably walked into the temple and they probably said, hey, let's sit down, let's have a talk. You know, where'd you come from? So what'd you do for a living before you started following this guy around and living, being homeless? And you know, what do you think about this? What is it? And they started talking to him about Jesus, and they started talking to him about his life, and they got to know him, and they drew a little closer to him, and they said, hey, listen, you know what? We really are looking for a way to get this guy. And we got some money, and you probably need it, because let's face it, you're homeless. Don't have a place to stay. You see, they conferred with him. They communed with him. They courted him, you might say, and tried to get him to do something that was very wrong. So what we have is basically the world continues to court us. And one thing I want to tell you is that we make a very big mistake sometimes when we think and believe that just because we become a Christian, the world doesn't care about us anymore. We think that just because of the fact that we're a Christian, people are going to going to leave us alone, and they're not going to tempt us, and they don't want us anymore because we've got on this new shirt that says Christian on it. And we walk around and we sometimes have this attitude. You know, a few months ago when I used to preach for a living, one of the things that I was really impressed with, or maybe depressed with, was the fact that people treated you differently when they found out what you did for a living. About a year ago, I was having some work done out at the farm, and the fellow that had been doing the work for me, nice guy, I would recommend him to anybody. just did a super job, did exactly what he said and exactly the time he said he was going to do it for exactly the amount. And just, well, but when I was out there talking to him and telling him what I wanted done, he was one of these people that just in his vernacular, he just would use some foul language. It just happened. He would just do it, and it was no, you know, I didn't go into it with him. Well, the last time that I went out there, he had been over next door, and he'd talked to my neighbor out there, and he had found out what I do for a living. And first thing he said to me when I walked up, he shook my hand. He said, he's kind of looked at me and said, I just want to apologize. I said, what did you do? What did you break out here? And he said, man, if I had known you were a preacher, I never would have used any foul language around you. And I said, you know, I hope that you learned that you don't need to use foul language around anybody. And I said, I want you to know that I'm a person just like you, and, you know, I don't have superpowers or anything like that. He looked at me, kind of laughed, and he said, I guess I do need to watch the way I talk, don't I? You know, I say that to say this. We need to understand, and we need to teach our kids, and we need to teach other people, that just because we're Christians, just because we've been baptized, temptation doesn't stop. People don't stop trying to get us to go back into the world. And we're still susceptible to all the bad stuff that goes on in the world. Now, what's the next thing Paul says to us? Let's look here in chapter 5. So what we get is that the world keeps on calling us and continues to want us to come back. Second point, verse 17 of chapter 5. For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. Now, I want to read this again out of the New Century Version. So I tell you, live by following the Spirit. Then you will not do the things that your sinful selves want. Our sinful selves want what is against the Spirit. And the Spirit wants what is against our sinful selves. And these two are against each other. You cannot do just what you please. Turn over to Romans chapter 7. It's always interesting. Same guy wrote Romans that wrote Galatians. And I think that many times Paul will almost repeat himself in his different letters. And one of the things he says in chapter 7, verse 15, and we'll read down through verse 24. For what I am doing, I do not understand, for what I will to do, that I do not practice, but what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law, and that is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil that I will not to do, that I practice. Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find then a law that is I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? You remember when you were little, I used to love cartoons. I still love cartoons. I used to love the Roadrunner and Coyote. They were some of my favorites, probably because there were no words. It was just noises and action nonstop. Do you remember the coyote was always interested in catching the Roadrunner? He always wanted to catch it so he could eat it. And do you remember on occasion the coyote would be standing there and he would be drawing out plans and trying to figure out how to catch this Roadrunner, and all of a sudden, bing, this little coyote-looking angel would pop up on one shoulder. And it would be telling him, you don't need to do this. He's a bird. He's not hurt you. It's okay. Leave the bird alone. And on the other shoulder, bing, this little coyote-looking devil with a little red suit and horns and a bifurcated tail. He would pop up, and he would all of a sudden be saying, "Get him. He's going to taste good. He's a bird. You know, who cares?" And it was always struck me as being odd that this thing that we see on cartoons is really a picture of what Paul is talking about here. Because there are two different sides to us, aren't there? Isn't there a part of us that desires to do things that are wrong? Isn't there? You know, listen, let's just be real for just a minute, okay? You remember what I said a minute ago about just because you're a preacher doesn't make you immune to sin, and just because you're a preacher doesn't make you, not have temptations to deal with. I'm going to clue y'all into something. Just because you're a Christian doesn't make you immune to temptations either. And part of our problem as Christians is this, folks, that we don't like to admit that, man, that's a temptation for me. We don't like to admit that, it's one of those things that we want to hold up our hand and we just don't want to look at something because it is a temptation. And sometimes I think we need to do that. We need to understand that what is a temptation for me and what bothers me and what seemingly draws me away and pulls me in a certain direction, it may not be a temptation for Jonathan. He may not be bothered by it. Wayne may not have the same issues and the same problems that I have in life, and I don't have the same that he does. And we've got to understand and we've got to admit and we've got to realize that none of us are perfect. And none of us are immune to sin, and none of us are immune to temptation. And what Paul is saying here is that, yes, there is a side of me. Paul's saying, I'm an apostle. He, the same guy that wrote the majority of the New Testament, standing there in Romans chapter 7, and he's saying, I don't understand why on earth it is that I keep doing this, whatever it is, that's wrong. And on the other side of the things, he says, and these things that I need to do and I know that I want to do, I don't do them because it is just a puzzling thing. Well, this is a major reason why people turn back into the world. It's because there are two sides to us. There is this fleshly side that, let's just face it, wants to do bad, wrong, sin. You remember in the Garden of Eden what it says there when after the man and the woman had eaten this fruit, it says their eyes were opened. And all of a sudden, they realized sin. They understood, they felt, they smelled, they saw. They had all of these senses and they saw what was wrong. And all of a sudden, there was this whole new side to them that was sin. We don't realize that sometimes. We look at ourselves and we don't realize sometimes how dangerous sin is. We don't give it the respect, so to speak, that it's due. Paul said here, look, it's a fact. The flesh lusts against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary one to another. There is one side of us that wants to do good and there's another side that wants to do bad, and they are antagonistic to each other. And they just don't get along. They're like oil and water. They don't mix. So what have we got so far? So far we've got two things. First of all, the flesh lusts against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. And there are two different sides to us. And there's a sinful side and a spiritual side. And before that we get that the world continues to call us. Outside those doors, those people, they continue to court us, want us to do wrong. Well, what's the last thing? What's the most difficult thing you've ever done physically in your life? Some of you probably have run a marathon. I've never done that. But I remember when I was about 14, 15 years old, every summer, we would have to haul hay. And my grandfather had cows. I like cows. Don't have anything against them as long as they're on a plate. And every summer, about the end of June, 1st of July, we'd have to haul hay. We had 20 acres out close to Cartwright. And we'd have it cut for hay every year. And in these little rectangular bales, weighed about 75 to 80 pounds each. And by the end of June, 1st of July, it's really hot. But you never got started doing this until 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we'd get out there, and it wasn't so bad the first hour or so. It was hot. You throw the bales of hay on the trailer, somebody else stacks it. Now it gets higher and higher, so you're by the end throwing it 10, 12 feet up in the air. You get it loaded, and then the real fun begins. You go back to the barn, have to unload it and stack it in a barn where it's 110 degrees and no air is circulating. And you do this until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and you go home. And you've sweated so much that you're dehydrated, and you have hay sticking in your ears and in your nose and everywhere, and you look like the Scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz. And I still remember I'd walk into Grandmama's house, and I'd just lay down on the floor and go to sleep because I was exhausted. I was tired. I'd had enough, and I couldn't take it. And I'm going to tell you what, that is the same reason a lot of people turn back, because they've had enough. They're tired and they're exhausted. And that's exactly what Paul says in Galatians 6, verse 9. Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Verse 6, let him who has taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Therefore, what a man sows, that will he also reap. For he who sows the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary. Let us not get tired of doing good. And it is so easy to get tired because it gets tiring. It gets tiring because the world continues to call us. Because we have friends out there and we have people that we work with, and we're not in a bubble. We have temptations that war in our flesh and our spiritual side and bother us and bombard us on each side. And we get tired. We get worn down. And we get to a point in life that we just throw up our hands and say, okay, I can't do it anymore. I can't try anymore. I can't work. I can't say no. I've said no enough, and I'm not going to say it anymore. I'm tired. One of the things that I do is occasionally I'll have the privilege, and I'll say privilege, of working with people who are drug and alcohol addicts. And I'm not going to get into a political discussion with you. But when people say that alcoholism, drug addiction is not a disease, well, you need to back up just a minute. It is a disease that we can prevent. I'll grant you that. It's something we can do something about. But it is a disease nonetheless. One of the things that I have learned in working with these people is this. You look at some of them who have, quote, fallen off the wagon, who've been sober for a period of time and have fallen, stumbled, and gone back to their old life. You ask them why, 9 times out of 10 they'll say, I just got tired of trying. I just got tired of saying no. It's not that all of a sudden they woke up one day and they said, you know what, this is a beautiful day. I think I'm going to go get high today. They didn't look outside and think, wow, this is a great day to go get drunk. That's not the way it works. They got tired. They were worn down. And the same thing happens to us as Christians. We get tired. We get worn down because we say no, because people ask us, people tempt us, and we get tired of saying no, and we get tired of saying no to the fleshly side of us, which has temptation. We get tired of it. You know what the greatest thing is when you see somebody who has been an alcoholic or drug addict? And you have seen that person, and you talk to them, and they have fallen again and again and again and again. And yet you watch them, and they get up, and they go through rehab. I had a young man I met first of this year. He had been on some drugs, alcohol. He said, "I've done everything you can think of." He said, "I had shot things into my body that I don't want to tell you about." Since he was 13 years old, his mother told me she had never seen him sober for more than 2 months at a time. And he has been in and out of rehab for more times than anybody can count. His parents, the state, he, himself, churches, everybody, individuals have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars sending him to rehab again and again and again. But you know what? November of this year, he will have been sober for a year. And it's not because some great thing happened in his life and exploded and he realized all of a sudden and the lights were turned on. It's for no other reason than he decided to try one more time to clean his life up, to straighten things out. And I'm going to tell you what. Whatever you're dealing with in life, whatever your big thing is, whatever temptation it is, whoever it is that keeps calling you, whatever it is that keeps attracting you in the world, you may have fallen. I don't know. You may have stumbled. I don't know. But I'm going to tell you what. I have so much respect for people that stumble and get up. Because you know what that says? That they're real. That they're not perfect. That they don't have this Hollywood textbook life where everything goes right and nothing goes wrong and they don't ever have problems and they don't ever have temptations. Because we all do. Every one of us. And we've got to make up our minds every day when we get up. Just today, I'm not going to get tired. Just today, I'm not going to fall. I'm not going to listen to whoever it is, whatever it is. I'm not going to be courted by that sinful life. I'm not just for today. I'm going to be what I need to be. I'm going to serve God, and I'm going to make a difference. That's the way you live your life. That's the way you conquer things in life, is just today, one day at a time. I think that's the way Paul did it. Paul said, "Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good. Every day, as you have an opportunity, do good. Every day, as you have opportunity, resist that temptation. Every day as you have an opportunity, make up your mind that you're not going to listen to that side of your body that wants you to do something that's wrong, or that person that's trying to get you to come back into whatever it is. Every day. Because we all have them. Every one of us. Now, these elders are great men. They're wonderful. But I guarantee you each and every one of them has things that they deal with. I guarantee you they do. I do. So let's go back to John chapter 6. Go back to John chapter 6. As we end this morning, as I ask you a question, think about this. Verse 60. Therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this saying, said, "This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?" Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured about this, and he said to them, "Does this offend you? What then, if you should see the Son of Man ascend where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words which I speak to you are spirit, and they are life. But there are some of you who do not believe." Jesus knew from the beginning that who they were who did not believe and who would betray him. And he said, "Therefore I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted him by the Father." And from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. Jesus said to the 12, "Do you also want to go away?" Simon Peter answered, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And also we have come to believe and know that you are the Christ, the Son of God." Where are you going to go? What are you going to turn to? This week, you may have the big sins in your life that we talk about. You may have problems with drugs or alcohol. I don't know. You may have a problem with some kind of a sexual problem in your life. I don't know. You may have little problems in your life. You may have a problem with anger and resentment. You may have a problem letting go and forgiving somebody. You may have problems. I don't know. There are so many things that we let get into our lives. You may have a problem with jealousy or covetousness. I don't know. But whatever your problem is, whatever you're dealing with, whatever it is that makes you tired of saying no, look at it in terms of what Peter said. Where are we going to go? He said to Jesus, "You have the words of eternal life. And we've come to believe that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." What are you going to turn back to? That's the question. Maybe it is that you're not a Christian. You've never become a Christian. You've never put on Christ. And maybe it is that in your life, that big thing is that little voice inside you that says, "There'll be another day. There'll always be one more day. You can do it tomorrow. You can do it next week. You can do it tonight." Maybe it is that it's that little voice that just keeps nagging you, telling you, put it off. But on the other side, there's that conscious part of your body and your life that's saying, "This is the greatest time in the world to become a Christian. This is the perfect time to turn my life over to Christ." Maybe it is that you've got something in your life that you need to get rid of and you need to confess. Maybe there is something that you've done that you need to get forgiveness of. And I'm going to tell you in just a second, when we stand up and sing, there's going to be one part of yourself that's going to be saying, "No, you don't need to say that. Nobody knows. Nobody here. Nobody cares. They can't forgive you for that. That's a big sin." Maybe it is that it's a little one. But there's going to be another side of you that's going to say, "It would feel so good to get rid of this. It would feel so great to gain forgiveness. It would feel so wonderful to just feel forgiven." But when I told you about hauling hay when I was younger, the best part about that whole ordeal was the ride to the barn. You get up on top of that stack of hay and you go down the road and that wind would hit you. And it would take your breath away. It felt so good. And I promise you, this is from somebody that knows, from somebody that's been there. There is no feeling in the world like getting forgiveness. There's no feeling in the world that feels so good as walking out those doors and knowing everything's okay. I'm good with my God. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, don't listen to that side of yourself that says, you'll have another time. You'll have another chance. Always be tomorrow. If you need to gain forgiveness, if you need to unload and feel that side of life, come down to the front while we stand up and while we sing.